am impressed. And wasn't that gorgeous driving with that gorgeous sunset? I'm Elaine Petrocelli, and I am from Book Passage, and the wonderful people who checked you in are from Book Passage. And we are so lucky that we have this wonderful partnership with Dominican and with Dr. Denise Lucy, who makes these events possible. And if you still have questions, feel free to sort of raise your hand and we'll get them to Michael Lewis. But I just want to tell you that this is the first of our spring series. And we are really, really happy that it's Geraldine Brooks and Michael Lewis, two of the superstars of the literary world. I'm not going to tell you a thing about them because someone else is, and you don't have to hear it again. But I'm excited. We are going to have a fabulous spring season. Rick Steves is coming March 15th for the most amazing book. When he was a young man, he went on what he called the hippie trail with his best friend, and it is a book in which he kept a journal, and it's everything he got from his journal, and it is delightful. And of course, we all know Rick Steves, because who would go traveling without Rick? And then on April 15th, Maria Shriver will be here in conversation with Anne Lamott, so don't miss that. And it's sort of a secret, so they've promised they've edited it out of the video, but Isabel Allende will be here May 10th with her great new novel, My Name is Amelia Davalle. It's a historical novel, and it is fabulous, because the best thing about being a bookseller is you get to read all this stuff first. We're going to have just a great event, and I'm very excited, and I thank all of you for supporting us. And I also want to thank President Nicola Pitchford, who is the leader of this wonderful university. And tonight we are very, very lucky because Dr. Pitchford, do you call it Dr. President? I'm not sure. But anyway, is going to come out and say a few words for us. So thank you, Dr. Pitchford, for coming.
I'm honored if Elaine just calls me friend. That's pretty special. And it's pretty special to be able to welcome you all. Lovely to see you for this first event of the spring series. My name's Nicola Pitchford. I'm the 10th president of Dominican University of California. Some of you know us. For some, this may be your first visit to our campus. I hope you'll come and see it in better weather. But we educate your nurses, your children's and your grandchildren's school teachers. Your doctors may have started their educational journey at Dominican. Your local business owner or your realtor, going to be thanking Christine for her support, could all have graduated from our MBA program. We have been teaching here for 135 years. And like many smaller independent nonprofit universities across the United States, we excel at doing a lot with a little. And today, it felt urgent for me to let you know who we are. We create opportunity for people who would never have thought that they could attend a four-year university, some of whom live just down the road. We embrace any student who will do best in a small, supportive environment. We have an exceptional track record of helping students from all backgrounds enroll in college and succeed in college. Each year, Dominican distributes more than $30 million in institutional aid to 99% of our undergraduate students. And today, more than 70% of our undergraduates identify as a race or ethnicity other than white. We do not have a large endowment fund. However, for the past decade, we have invested our own funds to develop critical and impactful approaches to serving low-income and underrepresented students. We've won national awards for this work, for truly making a difference. Our graduation rate is almost 30% higher than the national average. Several years ago, Dominican was named, and this was an incredibly proud moment for me, a federally designated minority-serving institution. Minority-serving institutions is a category that was created in 1965. I'd just say a number of good things were created in 1965. When, birthday friends, when President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Higher Education Act with the explicit goal of increasing the abysmal rate of minority students in higher education in the US. There is now a high risk that we will lose access to the federal funds that are critical to our work due to major changes in federal policy and direction. Such a funding loss would put into question our ability to continue our 135-year-old history of serving our county, our region, as effectively as we do. Small colleges like Dominican, I want you to know, are community gems, quietly doing really important transformative work. Now, like our students, Dominican is very resilient. We've overcome challenges in the past, depression, recession, pandemic. But with pressures adding up, we do welcome donor support right now more than ever. So today, I wanted to steal a minute of your evening and urgently invite you to visit our website, dominican.edu/give, and make a gift that can help replace the vital federal minority-serving institution grant funding that we expect to lose in the near future. I promise you our community will be the stronger for it. And now on to tonight's event. The Leadership Lecture Series, as you probably know, is a program of Dominican's Institute for Leadership Studies, founded and led by our distinguished executive director, Dr. Denise Lucy. The Institute is a leadership development center offering education and training to inspire students and professionals to become better leaders and team members. We thank Dr. Lucy, our student ambassadors, many of whom may have greeted you this evening, and everyone on campus whose teamwork ensures that the Leadership Lecture Series runs smoothly. The series celebrates this year its 20th anniversary, and we are incredibly proud of its legacy. And we could not do it without our partners in the lecture series, Book Passage, the San Francisco Bay Area's prized independent bookstore, which is itself now in its 48th year, for all that they do to bring accomplished and highly respected authors and change leaders to our campus and our community every year. We thank sincerely Elaine and Bill Petrocelli and the entire team at Book Passage who have been our friends and partners for their vision, commitment, and their belief in education and the importance of building community. And finally, let's thank the generous sponsors who made these events possible. Our silver sponsor is Dominican University's Women Leadership and Philanthropy Council, a giving circle welcoming not only women, but that inspires women to lead, collaborate, and contribute. Thank you, WLPC, for your unwavering support and community service. Our diamond sponsor for the spring lecture series is again Christine Christensen of Compass. Christine has represented the luxury real estate market in Marin for 22 years and earned her MBA in international business here at Dominican University. She's also a founding member of the Women Leadership and Philanthropy Council, and I am very grateful to Christine for her ongoing support of this program and of our university. I'd like to welcome Christine Christensen, who will introduce tonight's speakers. And thank you for giving me your time.
Thank you.
you so much.
Good evening. It is my honor to welcome the Pulitzer Prize-winning and best-selling author Geraldine Brooks to Dominican University for the first time to launch the release of her new memoir, Memorial Days. Tonight is the first event of Ms. Brooks's new tour, and we're honored that she chose Dominican University to host it. You are among the first to experience this beautiful new work. Memorial Days is a heart-rending, deeply personal memoir of sudden loss and a journey towards peace. When Geraldine Brooks received a phone call that her partner of more than three decades, Tony Horowitz, just 60 years old, and to her knowledge, vigorous and healthy, suddenly collapsed and died on a Washington, D.C. sidewalk, her world turned upside down. Memorial Days is a portrait of a larger-than-life man and a timeless love between souls, exquisitely capturing the joy, agony, and mystery of life. Geraldine Brooks is the author of six novels, including Horse, People of the Book, Year of Wonders, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning March. She's also the author of acclaimed nonfiction works, including Nine Parts of Desire and Foreign Correspondence. Her writing has been translated into over 25 languages, collectively selling millions of copies worldwide. Moderating tonight's discussion is best-selling author Michael Lewis. Mr. Lewis has published numerous books on subjects ranging from politics to Wall Street. His newest number one New York Times bestseller is Going Infinite. It tells the story of FTX's collapse and the enigmatic founder at its center, Sam Bankman-Fried. Among Mr. Lewis's other popular releases are The Big Short, Boomerang, The Blind Side, Moneyball, The New Thing, and Liar's Poker. He also hosts Apple's number one podcast, Against the Rules. We have a fascinating discussion ahead with two supremely talented writers, so let's get to it. Please join me in welcoming Geraldine Brooks and Michael Lewis to our stage.
All right, so I'm gonna start by just explaining how we know each other. Because Geraldine and I go back a long way, and we've shared a lot of life, and we shared some death. 1990, I think it was, end of 1989, my first book had just come out. It was Liar's Poker. I was living in London, and the Wall Street Journal trashed it, like 2 days after it came out. And it was a boring book, and no one should read it, and whatever, whatever. And a few days after that, I had a message on my answering machine in London from a Wall Street Journal writer named Tony Horowitz saying he wanted to come profile me. And I was like, fuck you. Like, you're not coming anywhere near me. And so I just deleted it. And he was unbelievably persistent. He called again and again. I deleted all of it. And then one day, creepily, I come home to my little house in North London, in Hampstead. And there's a pile on my doorstep from him. And it's his clips showing that he comes in peace. There's a long letter about how he doesn't like the guy who reviewed the book. And really, I need to be in touch with him. And I said, fuck you. And I talked. I don't trust you as far as I could throw you. Whoever you are, Tony Horowitz. And I threw it all away. And then one day I'm walking out of my house, and my house was a semi-detached on a little path on a graveyard. It was really tucked away. And so there was another half of the house. And there is a young couple moving into the other house. And it's them. And Tony had seen the house next door was for sale when he came up to drop his clips and just bought the other side of the house. And then lost complete interest in having anything to do about writing about me. So this is, and they at the time are basically foreign correspondents, war correspondents for the Wall Street Journal. You were in and out of London, you were there, you were not there, and you were not there, you were in the most harrowing places in the world. And I kind of watched them in action. And they were two very different people. But they were, you know, I thought they were newspaper journalists. Tony seemed to have more book ambition than Geraldine at the time. I didn't know what was lurking inside her, that there was this monster waiting to come out and take us all over with her novels. But she was, she had this other dimension to her. But I do remember, and with such relief, picking up their stuff in the Wall Street Journal and thinking, my God, they're good. Like, I liked them instantly. We became friends instantly. But, you know, there's always this problem. Your friends aren't always the best writers. And I've spent a lot of time lying to friends about liking their stuff. and I sit here with just a clear conscience because I've loved her stuff from the minute I read it in the Wall Street Journal. And there was, you could tell from the war correspondence that there was something else there, that she wanted to do more than that, as much as that was. So now here we sit before you, and Geraldine has written a book about Tony's death and her experience of that death. And we're gonna talk about that for a while, and we'll talk about other things too. And I've promised that this is not going to be a sad and mournful occasion, because Tony was anything but sad and mournful. We want his spirit here with us. And so we were just talking about stage, and this book is published today. In a week, this would be standing room only in the back, because the book is going to be a sensation. And she's doing she's not doing what she normally does, which is go do anything anybody will ask her to do. She's doing 8 public appearances, a tiny bit of media, all the things she's doing on stage are with people who knew Tony. And then she's going to disappear again, and she says she's never going to talk about the book again. But so we have her for a moment, and we're going to get everything we can out of her. But before we move to the book, you did a couple of interviews today. You loved one, and you didn't like the other. And you loved the one, I want you to explain why, and what happened in those interviews, because this is a delicate subject.
Yeah, so this is a book about Tony's death, but it's also a book about his life. And when I wrote it, I really wasn't thinking of it like a normal book. It was something that I did for myself because I needed to do it. And I wasn't going to do any publicity or a book tour for it at all. But then I got to thinking, well, it's a book about Tony, and I love talking about Tony. So maybe I can do a little bit for it. And we'll see how it goes. The interviews were very instructive about what's going to work for me and what isn't. The first one was great because we mostly talked about Tony. And the second one was all about grief and how you deal with it and mourning. And it's a very important subject, but it's not a place that I want to live in my head. And I think you've had some experience with this, too.
So Geraldine was godmother to our daughter, Dixie, who was killed in a car accident 3.5 years ago.
She was only 19, and she was the most radiant, incredible girl.
And I spoke at Tony's memorial service, and Geraldine spoke at Dixie's memorial service. So we have collided in this space.
Yeah.
But have not really spent a whole lot. We haven't really spoken of it.
We haven't spoken about it. I don't know how you got the news, actually, because to me the way I got the news was, I think, a disaster and very cruel, and it should never be done that way.
Let's start there. It's because the book, the way you tell me when I go wrong. Mm-hmm. You tell me if I say something stupid. But the book's it's two interwoven narratives, and the one narrative is the first year after Tony's death, and it's the bureaucracy of death. It's you're just dealing with the facts of the death and what happens. And it ends in a church in Martha's Vineyard at his memorial service where I spoke. Mm. I don't understand why you didn't use my last name when you described my talk. I felt like
okay,
it was a
was,
pretty good talk, and I should get some credit for it.
All right, I'm going to tell you.
But okay. All right, put a pin in that. But the other narrative is you just a couple of years ago going away to an island in Tasmania, called
Flinders.
Flinders Island, to marinate, to get in touch with how you felt about all this, and you brought Tony's journals with you, among other things, but you're kind of just alone. And I think of this sort of like as an outward-facing story and an inward-facing story kind of thing. So let's start with the outward-facing story, like how you learned about your husband's death.
You know, I think popular culture leads you to believe that if you're ever going to get this kind of terrible news of a sudden death, somebody's going to come to the door.
Yeah.
And somebody's going to say, are you sitting down? And is there anyone we could call? And would you like a glass of water? And it doesn't happen like that at all. It's just you pick up the phone on any given day, and there's a tired resident at the end of her shift 500 miles away who just basically says your husband's dead and can't get you off the phone fast enough. And I just, that was... The catastrophe of him dying would never be anything less than a catastrophe, but there has to be a better way.
Yeah, but that's just the beginning of kind of like a series of sort of like, I mean, you're it's almost as if the world didn't want to engage with you in a human way.
No, it's everybody turns into kind of a robot. But I mean, what happened with you? Did anyone come to the door, or what happened?
So I was alone in the house with I sleep with the wave machine on, so I can't hear anything. And apparently the police did come and rang the doorbell at 3 a.m, but I didn't hear them. So I didn't find out till 7 a.m. when I was woken up by someone. So a babysitter came and woke me up. And my experience, I mean, it's a little different, but my experience was that all of a sudden you are cast, it was so, I mean, the trauma of it is breathtaking, and there are no words to put to it right away. But you're in the position of talking to coroners, talking to morgues, talking to people who, what do you do with the body?
And getting there, right? And, I mean, you want to be there.
Yes, I got stopped. Because it was 5 hours north or 4 hours north, and no one would let me get in a car. But that was my first impulse too, but I remember the feeling. It is so strange that all the people I'm talking to are strangers, and this is just one more death that they're seeing this day.
Yeah.
And it isn't that they are unsympathetic; it's that they're kind of numb.
Yeah.
And it was you're dealing with this world of numb people, and I didn't expect anymore. I didn't come away. There's still an anger in your book about this, in your story.
I'm angry for everybody this is happening to right now, and I know that I come from a position of privilege, you know, compared to other people for whom this is going to change their material circumstances, who are going to lose not only the person they love, but perhaps their house and everything, you know, that comes with it. That wasn't us, so I understand. But just that there are better ways. And I know this from the way it happens in Australia. It doesn't happen like this. And you get to go to the morgue and be with the body, and they give you as much time as you want, and they prepare you to go in there, and how, you know, if there's injuries, what they are, and even what color blanket is going to be on your beloved's corpse. And it's not a lot, you know, to ask, really, is it?
No.
Yeah.
No. So I want to come back to that, but I want to talk first just about how you thought about writing about it, because I've already dismissed the idea of writing a book about Dixie's death. Mm. I thought that it wasn't the form. It's not the form that popped into my mind. So when did you think I want to start putting words down on a page about this experience? And then tell me how you thought about doing it. Let's talk craft for a minute around this subject.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't really thinking craft in this case, but
But you were. It's crafted.
So the first year, I couldn't do anything except look after my kids and I have two sons, and deal with the like the flaming torches that are in the air. Modern life, it's very complicated. Tony and I had a pretty traditional distribution of tasks, and we'd been married for 35 years, so I had not had to think about the things that he thought about for 35 years, and I had no clue about how he did what he did. So there was just getting my hands around that so that one of these flaming torches didn't set the house on fire before I dealt with it, including losing my credit cards, losing my health insurance, trying to figure out why he had puts on something in the Tokyo Stock Exchange.
I can only imagine what you discovered when you started mucking around in Tony's financial life, because Tony was a gambler.
He loved to take a bet.
Yes, he did. He died owing me dinner for a bet on the Rams. I'm serious.
Well, I can pay that tonight.
I really have promised. I'd promised myself for the last 5 years I would not bring that up ever, and I just brought it up. I don't know. It was the Rams Saints playoff game, and he would, every time I saw him, he'd poke me with a stick and say, "Come on, let's bet on something. Let's bet on something."
Oh, he did, and I think you put it most beautifully in your eulogy, which Tony's life, his reporting life, was all about him taking a bet on a stranger and them taking a bet on him.
Yep.
And you know, he went through his life in that way. He
took enormous personal risks with people.
Yeah.
And he let the people sense that. I remember. We're going to digress into Tony for a minute. This is not a structured conversation.
Yeah,
you're quickly
going
to determine. I didn't know what to do with this except sit up here and talk to you like a friend. But I remember soon after we met, you told me a story, and it must have happened before I met you, about Tony in the desert when the Iraqis were about to plow under a whole bunch of bodies of dead Iranians.
Yeah,
tell me that story.
Yeah, so is this, everybody's forgotten that before there was the international blockbuster, the Gulf War I and II,
yeah,
there was the foreign subtitled version, Iran, Iraq, and over a million young people died in that war. Young Iranians were told they're going straight to heaven if they just marched into the guns of young Iraqis, who were all of them conscripts. So we were in the battlefield, aftermath of a terrible battle that the Iraqis had won, and it was strewn with corpses of young Iranians. And they just had brought in great big earth-moving machines to change around the fortifications, to point the berms in one direction instead of the other, and they're just rolling over these dead kids, and it was, you know, a nightmare. Tony jumped out of the press car and stood in front of that bulldozer and argued with the Iraqis that the least they could do was take the dog tags of these kids so that their parents could be informed one day of what had happened to them. And I thought that was the bravest and craziest thing I'd ever seen, and it made me love him even more.
Yeah, it made me love him even more when you told me that. It was a remark. And how did they respond?
They stopped.
I'm surprised they didn't shoot him.
This crazy American.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about your relationship with Tony. The questions I never got to ask that I got to read about a little bit in here. How did you meet and how did you fall in love?
So we met, I came to the United States to go to graduate school at Columbia Journalism School. And he arrived there having decided that being a union organizer for poor black woodcutters in Mississippi was going to be a very slow way to effect social change. And so he arrived with a suntan and an ulcer from that job. And we met on the first week of class at a party, and I thought he was very funny. He told lots of funny stories about living in Alphabet City, which was a rough neighborhood in those days. And the next day, there was a big lecture theater called the World Room, and we were assembling for our first class joint meeting. And I saw that cute blonde guy across the hall, and I waved to him, and he didn't wave back. And I'm like, fuck you and the horse you rode in on. And I didn't think about him again until 6 months had passed and we found ourselves in the same class because we're both lefties and we both decided that as journalists we would be muckrakers and we would be the Ida Tarbell of the 1980s and smash capitalism. So we needed to learn how it worked. So we're in a business reporting class. And we just started to really admire each other. And as I got to know him, he told me he hadn't waved back that morning in the Waldroom because he'd been out with his brother the night before and they'd been drinking at Danceteria and he'd lost his glasses down the toilet. So he couldn't even see me. And then when he did see me, he noticed I was always sitting next to a handsome guy called Bronstein, and he thought we were an item. And I had to point out to him that the class was seated alphabetically.
I mean, I hate to be asking these personal questions, but how did it start?
With a dance, actually.
Oh.
He was having a party at his a fairly disgusting apartment. And he just grabbed my arm and we started dancing and we kind of never stopped.
Yeah. If I had met you both then and asked, what do you want your careers to be? What would you each have said?
I would have said journalism 100%. It was all I had ever wanted to do from the time I was 8 years old. I went to see where my dad worked as a proofreader on the Sydney newspaper, and he took me down to the press room, and he grabbed one of the papers as it came off the presses, and it was warm. It was hot in my hand because it was hot off the press. And I looked down at that inky headline and thought to my eight-year-old self, I'm the first one who knows what's going on. And I wanted that, and that was what I pursued. Tony loved journalism, but he didn't like being told what to do.
Yeah.
And so when he wrote his first book, he realized that that was much more what he wanted.
What was it, One for the Road?
One for the Road. I had dragged him to Australia after we got married. And he had an incredible energy and curiosity about the country, so he decided he would hitchhike right across the and all around the country and send back dispatches. And luckily, the Sydney Morning Herald trusted his instincts and let him do it. And it was a fantastic series, and a publisher approached him, and that was his first book.
Did he have impulse to this impulse to be a historian?
Yeah, no, he had started
That's
out
where he was
very
drifting.
Much. I think he drifted away from it because he was, you know, he got the history prize at Brown University and he was destined to be a historian. And then his social activism kicked in and he wanted to be more in the engaged in the current project. But then as a book writer, he married the two together in the most wonderful way, and I think he was very prescient in his work in that he saw the way this country was fracturing and all the lines along which those fractures were starting to happen, north and south, urban and rural, income inequality. He got the Pulitzer Prize for a series on low-wage work in America, which, if carefully read, you know, everything that he points out in that series has come to pass. And, you know, that's when the invasion of the Capitol happened, he was already gone, but I looked at those guys with the Confederate flags busting into the Capitol, and I thought, Tony has probably had a beer with at least 10% of those guys. Huh. And I wished he had been there to cover this moment.
You, when you go away to Flinders Island, you have bits of his journal or all of his
journal? No, I just picked four out randomly because I had it's a small plane, you can't take a ton of baggage.
What you describe in the journal was so interesting, it made me want to go get the rest of it. I assume you've read it all?
Yeah, I've read it all now, yeah.
Give me a sense of how, what surprised you.
So, you know, Tony was a pretty sunny person, mm-hmm. very upbeat and a ton of fun, and the journals are not that guy.
No?
That's not the guy who needed the journals. The journals are very much where he went with his anxieties, which it turns out were legion, and his insecurities.
He didn't let you see these?
Oh, no, this was his private.
No, I meant the insecurities.
Oh, no, hardly at all. Hardly at all. So I'm lying on the deck of this shack miles from nowhere, and I'm reading this passage in the journal, and I find myself hooting with laughter because he has just written, I have come to the realization that I will probably never amount to much in journalism. And he's like 2 years off winning the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting.
So it surprised you that he had this other side to him that you didn't...
Yeah, the extent of it surprised me. It wasn't the only surprise.
The girlfriend.
It surprised me how many girls he slept with at Columbia before we got together.
This was in the journal. Yes. Do you come across yourself in the journal?
I do come across myself, you know, inauspiciously at first. So he's had a really terrible day, which is why he's journaling. He was sick, and there was a long line at the student health service. And then one of his casual paramours had thrown a beer in his face and told him she hated him that day. But we had had a bet.
Of course.
And I had won it. Huh. And he owed me a bottle of champagne. So the first reference to me in the journal is drinking champagne with Geraldine and everything is all right.
Oh. All right, so back to the question that we got distracted from is how you craft this thing, how you think about writing this thing. When do you first think, I need to write about this?
So the first year was really just a lost year. And then after that, because society kind of expects you to, I tried to start acting normally and doing things that normal women do, like being the secretary of the high school PTO and going back to being a conservation commissioner in the town of West Tisbury and trying to finish my book. And I realized 2 years into it that that was exactly what it was. It was still an act. I'm acting this part of woman being normal, but I don't feel it at all. Because of the suddenness of the death and all the things I had to do in the wake of it, I have never properly done the business, the work of grieving. And it came, I don't know why I didn't think of it earlier, because right is right. That's what we do. That's how we figure out what we think. It's how we make sense of the world. And I thought, maybe I just need to stop doing everything else and just write about what happened, revisit that time when I didn't take the time to mourn and actually take it. And so I took myself off to the remotest place I could think of.
Why did you pick it?
I picked it because I'd been there before when we were early in our marriage, and I was working on what I thought would be research for what I thought would be a really good novel. It was going to be my second novel. Mm-hmm. And it took me to this island, and Tony came, because we often came with each other on research trips as a second pair of eyes and ears soaking up detail. And I loved it there. I just thought it was a gorgeous place, and I imagined that maybe one day we could move there. And I broached that to Tony, and he changed the subject very quickly.
He would go insane.
It would not have suited him.
Tony was
too social for a small community like that.
And he needed stimulation.
Yeah. Also, he hates small planes. So so it was not. It would not have worked. But it was always in the back of my mind, that beautiful place, Flinders Island. So that's where I went.
So when you think about what it means to do the work of grieving, what does it mean?
So, you know, they say for PTSD and for what they call complicated grief, which is grief that goes on for a long time. One of the therapies for it is to revisit the moment over and over again and try and recall more and more detail about it. And in some ways, that is supposed to be a healing therapy. Well, I didn't go to a therapist. I went to Flinders Island. I got out my writing persona, and I did that work. And that's what I did instead of therapy.
So did you do anything? Did you do anything you were supposed to do? Did you do, you didn't, you never did therapy. Did you ever do anything, anybody, did you ever read books about grief? Did you ever?
Not until I got to Flinders Island, actually, because people are very kind and they give them to you, but I was very self-protective about what I read in the immediate aftermath.
Why?
Well, you and I have talked about this because it's so different for everybody, and I couldn't imagine how what anybody else had experienced would be that useful to me. There are some things, I mean, there's something that I quote, Jennifer Senior did a beautiful short monograph on grief, and in it she quotes a therapist who said, it's like you and your family are in a plane that has crashed into the top of a mountain, and you all have to get to the bottom of the mountain, but you've all got broken bones, so you can't help each other. And you'll all have to find your way down alone. And that really helped me in thinking about what I could do for my sons, because inevitably we all had to find our way down alone.
You couldn't do it for them?
No. Yeah.
I had exactly the same feeling. Instantly, I had the same feeling that no one could help me and I couldn't help really anybody else. It was an odd feeling, because who goes there in their head? Mm. And the metaphor, the picture that popped into my mind was I was in a jungle with a machete, and I had to get through the jungle. And there was a path, but I had to find the path by myself.
Right.
So I had that feeling. It is at some point, it must have struck you to be grateful for the fact that you do what you do for a living, and you have words to go to.
So it took me, but I'm still like, head-slapping moment. Why did it take me so long? I might have been able to get down that mountain a lot quicker if I'd just written about it from the beginning. I don't know. I'll never know. But, you know, you asked me about reading these grief memoirs. So I took a few of them to Flinders Island with me, and one that I took was this tattered, really grungy galley of Year of Magical Thinking, the Uber grief memoir, yep. Joan Didion. And we had this tattered galley because Tony had been judging the National Book Award that year. And this book of Didion's won. And I open it up, and no thanks to Judge Tony. Because he had scrawled on the front page, name dropping, padded. So that's why your name is not in this book, because Tony's ghost would have come back and said, you're dropping Michael Lewis's name.
He didn't like the book.
He did not care for the book.
It wouldn't have been his kind of book, no.
He did not care for it. But it was fun. Yeah, we had an argument about how he treated books. I'm very precious about my books. I would no sooner write on a book than, you know, scratch a mark in an old master's painting. And he just wrote all through them. And now I'm so glad about that, because it's like having a discussion with him. If I pick up a book of his that I haven't read, I can know what he thought of it, which is a real gift.
There are a bunch of different directions I kind of want to go, and I'm not sure which is the best here. But I want to know a little bit just how sensitive you are to how it, I mean, you say that after a year, you're expected to play the role of everything's normal again, or everything's okay, and everything wasn't okay. But also, you're cast in a different role. You're the grieving widow. You're the person who's lost someone. And you walk into the room and you know that people are thinking about it. Whereas before, that's not what they were thinking. It follows you everywhere. It's your shadow all of a sudden. How did you feel about that?
So I got great advice right after he died. Probably, you know, this wonderful friend insisted on coming right over as soon as I got back from Washington, D.C., which is where I had immediately had to get to. And he said, I've got advice for you. And the first piece of advice he gave me was about what had happened when his beloved wife had died. And the first time he had steeled himself to go out to dinner, nobody talked about her. And he was furious. And then he realized that they hadn't talked about her because they weren't sure how he would be with that. And he said, what you have to do is bring Tony into the conversation first thing to make it safe for everybody
else.
You have
to give people permission.
Yeah. Do you find that?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
People don't know what to say.
Yeah.
They don't know if they're even supposed to say anything.
Right.
They don't know what they're going to trigger in you.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there are people who step over bound. I mean, they don't know people are people.
You told me about the person who said, you will never get over this.
Your
daughter.
Four days after.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, why would you ever say that? We were laughing about it. It was like, why would anybody do this?
Yeah.
Did you resist the role? You have resisted the role of someone that I'm supposed to feel sorry for.
Well, I'm, you know, you're so lucky until you're not.
Yep.
This was my big slab of unlucky that I got handed. You got handed a bigger slab of unlucky.
I don't know. These things can't be compared.
But I'm very cognizant that not many people have 35 years of an incredibly happy marriage.
Yeah.
And so I try and hold on to that.
How do you explain that you lost, I knew your mother.
Yes.
She was fantastic.
She was.
She was so full of piss and vinegar. It was so clear where you came from.
That was the biggest piece of luck in my life is having that mother. But you met her when she was failing and she was still terrific.
She had this energy about her.
Yeah.
It's a little similar to the energy you have about her. And in both cases, I was a little bit frightened of you both. You still frighten me. I never know when you're going to just put me in my place, but you did it right.
Well, somebody's got to do it.
But you've always done it, and I just never know when it's coming. And just when I think we're going to get comfortable here, it gets a little uncomfortable. So your mother had the same thing, and I could see kind of where it came from. But you lost your mother.
Yeah. But she was 95,
she
had dementia for 15 years, and that was hard.
So I'm trying to get at why the blow is the blow. Is it the suddenness?
I think it was the suddenness because when you lose a 95-year-old, and my dad was 87 and had lived, you know, he was lucky to get to 87, the life he lived. He was crazy. But you expect certain things about how your life is going to be.
There you go. You're on. That's what I thought you might say.
Yeah.
Yeah. That you are moving through the world with assumptions about how the world is.
Big plans, you know.
But you just assume, you know, we assume that a meteor is not going to hit this place. It's all, in 12 minutes, we're going to be done and walk out and just move on, and the world's not going to change. And you've got this kind of simulation you're running all the time. It's what reality is. And the death of a parent at that age, you've already prepared for it in some way.
Totally prepared for it.
Your mind has gotten you used to the idea.
Yeah.
And there is a thing that happens when you lose a piece of the reality you really did never expect to lose. It just did not cross your mind. That is so disruptive to the mind. What I found for quite a long stretch after Dixie died I was surprised by how exhausted I was all the time.
Oh yeah.
And it took me a while to figure out. I'm so tired because my mind is having to rewire reality every day. It's still doing it. You know, it's not over. And it's a reality without her in the space.
Yeah.
And did you have anything like that experience with Tony?
All the time. And just having, that was one of the things that happened when I was on Flinders Island. I arrived there with a bag full of crap. Basically. And I was just slowly unpacking one piece of this heavy crap after the other. And the biggest piece, I think, that I was able to leave behind there was the mourning, not so much for him, because that will never stop, but the mourning for the life that I expected to have with him.
There you go.
And I was able to shut that down and say, that is gone. You will never get that life, so embrace the life you have and make it as vivid and meaningful as you possibly can.
Yeah. What would he think about how you responded to his death? Would he be more, would he be pissed off?
I think he'd be really surprised that I've managed to file the taxes without getting an extension.
Or figure out what the put was on the new, right, the Tokyo Stock Exchange. Yeah. Yeah, that's probably true. What do you think he'd make of the book?
I don't know. He'd probably think it was over the top.
He'd think the parts about him were too sentimental.
I think he'd, you know, I could imagine, you know, I actually say it in the book because I wanted to quote from the obituaries because some of them just got him so beautifully. And I can imagine him just putting a red line through that whole page.
Yeah.
And saying, cut this bragging.
So we still haven't quite, I want to digress from, before I digress into, I want to get at how you became a novelist, because everybody here has read your novels. They're all so good that I can't remember which one won the Pulitzer Prize, because they all could have won the Pulitzer Prize. But just the crafting of the book, this book. Okay. How did you decide? You got to sit down. You're
third
sitting down
time's
with a blank.
Third time's a charm. You've
yes,
asked me
I'm
three times.
Yes, I'm trying again. We'll try one more time.
All right.
You're sitting down with a blank sheet of paper. What are you going
to
do?
So I went there to the island to just to relive the worst day of my life and what came after, to try and get back to the point where I hadn't allowed myself a florid grief, a scream, any reaction that you might have expected to have to this news, because I thought if I let myself go, I was all alone in the house, and I thought if I crack now, I might not be able to put myself back together to do what I have to do next. So I didn't allow it to happen, so I wanted to get back to that point. So I knew I was going there to write about that time, but while I was there, I was also writing about the process of writing about the time, and I was writing about things I noticed on the island, because that's what writing basically is fanatical noticing. And I realized...
Ooh, that's great. That's true.
Yeah, and I realized that nature was being very restorative to me. You know, this place is amazingly beautiful. And there was nobody else for miles, so it was just me and nature and these wallabies that would come at dusk every day and the incredible bird life and the ocean. And so I was just noticing and writing, and I realized that I had two strands emerging. And so it became obvious to me.
What are those two strands?
So it was the reliving of the pretty terrible months after his death, interleaved with the work I was trying to do on the island, letting nature work its healing powers, and thinking about, you know, Tony and the incredible gift that our marriage was.
When you were writing it, did you have any problems? Anything get in the way of telling the story?
No, because I wasn't writing it for anybody else. It wasn't like...
Did you think you were going to publish it?
No, I didn't think I wasn't going to publish it, but I wasn't thinking about a readership for it.
Because is that different from the other books?
Oh, totally different. You know, I think, you know, when you're writing a novel, the excitement of it is, God, somebody's going to read this, and they're going to engage with it, and they're going to imagine how the characters look. And it's a mystical bond between you and your reader. But I'm sorry, readers, I really wasn't thinking about you at all when I wrote this. I wrote this because I needed to write it.
So you didn't have that kind of that snag in your head of what the reader is going to think.
No, I didn't.
Did it come faster as a result?
I think it came faster because I didn't have to schlep all over the country researching something. You know, when I'm writing one of my novels, the research takes you into all kinds of rabbit holes and archives and trips to places, and I didn't need any of that. This was all in here.
So we only have a few more minutes, and the questions from the audience, a lot of them were about the various books you've written. And we could go through all of them, but let's just pick one, and the one I want to pick is Horse. Mm-hmm. Because that was the one you were working on when Tony died.
Yeah.
And you had the courage to come back to it and finish it.
It took me a while. It took me a year to crawl back to that desk. But I wanted to finish it because he really loved this project, and he had really not liked the one before it. I was doing The Secret Chord, which was set in Second Iron Age Israel. And he could give us stuff about stuff that happened in the Second Iron Age. He loved antebellum America. And right. So when I'm writing in that period, I am in his happy place. So he had helped me a lot because he is such a skilled archive diver and historian. And so he would find wonderful little tidbits and drop them on my desk like love gifts. And so I really wanted to finish the book so I could dedicate it to him. And it was you, actually, who, as an early reader, pointed out something that I had not grokked.
I don't even remember what it was.
You said you realized that this book is very different in the second half to the first half, that there's grief all over it. Hmm. And I realized it was. The book became very different because I was different. Mm.
Where was it? Where were you in it when he died?
Halfway.
You'd written half of it.
Yeah, and I'd been reading it to him, and he'd been giving me feedback on it. So he was so involved in Horse. Yeah, and I had a big wobble because there was all the discourse about appropriation and American dirt, and you know, authors were being put through the shredder. If you're a white person writing about black lives, and I thought, oh my God, I'm so canceled. And I was going to give it up, and he actually conspired with our lovely shared literary agent, Chris Dahl, to make sure I didn't. She told me, you've spent the advance, you have to keep going. And he put her up to it.
When you picked it up after he died, was the experience of writing different from what it was before he died?
It was once I could concentrate again. You know, what you were saying about being tired, I just couldn't concentrate. My mind was like a hummingbird. I couldn't figure out which plant to land on. But once I got back into the routine, you know, I'm pretty disciplined writer. Not as much as you, but pretty disciplined. I used to see him when we lived in Hampstead. You know, when you share a party wall, there are very few secrets. And Tony and I, if we were at home, we would flop in front of the BBC and, you know, watch some drama. And this guy would have been writing all day, and at 11 o'clock at night, you'd see him come out and go for a run.
I didn't look like that. But okay.
And then he'd come back and keep writing. And when I took a leave of absence to write my first book, which was a nonfiction book, Nine Parts of Desire, yep. He would see me wandering around Hampstead in the day, and he at one point he could stand it no longer. He said, this book will never get written until you put your bum in the seat and stay there. It's good
true.
Advice.
The best advice I've ever given every writer is put your ass in the chair.
And, you know, it's the necessary, if not the sufficient, condition.
Yeah, nothing's going to happen unless you do it.
That's right.
Last question. You set out to be a journalist. You've become a novelist. How do you explain it?
Oh, I explain it very easily, and I've explained it before, but it's the only story I've got because it's true. I loved journalism. I thought it was an extraordinary privilege to be explaining the consequences of foreign policy that gets made in the White House or in Whitehall, and seeing how the effects of that play out in real lives and how devastating that often is, and being able to write that back to an audience like the Wall Street Journal's audience, some of whom have some power to do something about it. So I loved the work, and I hadn't ever thought about doing anything different. And then the Nigerian secret police did me a big favor, as it turned out, because they threw me in the slammer for reporting about what Shell Oil was up to in the Niger Delta. And I'm lying on the concrete floor of this unlovely lockup in Port Harcourt, Nigeria, and I go, "You're 39 years old and you forgot to get pregnant." And I didn't know how long they were going to keep me, and I thought, "You've probably blown it, you know?" And then they deported me, yay, after 3 days. And I came home and I greeted Tony with great enthusiasm.
Ladies and gentlemen, Geraldine Brooks. I'll see you again.
Yeah.